welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Wednesday, August 17th, 2022. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. Today's headline is Jury Finds Dubuque Man Guilty of Murder by Eric Hogstrom. Mark T. Fischler is facing a life sentence. A jury deliberated for less than 2 hours before finding a Dubuque man guilty of first-degree murder Tuesday. Mark T. Fischler, 61, was convicted in the death of Bernice Williamson, 80, of Dubuque. Williamson was found dead on July 15, 2021, inside her home on Clark Drive. Authorities had indicated that Fischler, then the boyfriend of Williamson's niece, Kathleen M. McCarthy, was the last known person to see Williamson alive, having been at her residence July 14, 2021. A neighbor found Williamson dead in her residence July 15th, lying just inside her back door with a roll of carpet over her head, documents state. A deputy state medical examiner who performed the autopsy on Williamson testified earlier in the trial that she died of blunt force injuries to the head. Fischler sat impassively as Iowa District Court Judge Monica Zrini Ackley read the unanimous verdict shortly after 4 p.m. Tuesday. Jurors had received the case around 2 p.m., then were scheduled to eat lunch before beginning deliberations. After discharging the jury, Ackley told prosecutors and the defense attorneys that she would set hearings for pre-sentencing motions and sentencing at a later date. A conviction of first-degree murder carries a mandatory life sentence without parole in Iowa. Prosecutors had asked jurors to consider circumstantial evidence in a case in which there were no eyewitnesses and a lack of genetic evidence linking the suspect to the crime. We would like to thank the jury for all of their hard work, and the verdict was a good chance for the family to get some closure, Dubuque County District Attorney C.J. May III said after the verdict was announced. May prosecuted the case with Assistant Iowa Attorney General Douglas Hammerend. Williamson's family spoke among themselves after the verdict was announced. They declined to offer comment. Steve Dreyazal, one of Fischler's defense attorneys, also declined to comment on the verdict or the case. The verdict capped a day featuring a lengthy court proceeding in the trial, in which opening statements began August 10th. Tuesday's session began at 9 a.m. and concluded around 2 p.m., with one brief break around 10:30 a.m. "Accept the evidence you find more believable," Hammerin said to the jury during his closing arguments. Fischler's defense attorneys had pointed to the areas of the prosecution's case that could cast reasonable doubts on the events surrounding Williamson's death during their closing statements Tuesday. Dreyazal said to the jury that the state's case consists of a chain of facts with missing links that are crucial in answering questions about Williamson's death. "The state wants to see something, so they see something that isn't there," Dreyazal said of the prosecutor's case. Prosecutors said mounting circumstantial evidence pointed to Fischler as the most likely perpetrator of Williamson's death, providing a motive and means to commit the crime. "The law makes no distinction between direct or circumstantial evidence," Hammerend said. Hammerend told the jury that a chain of facts in this case indicates Fischler needed money and that he was the last person known to have seen Williamson alive. Hammerin said testimony shows that Fischler asked a friend to lend him $10 on July 13th and had run out of available minutes on his cell phone. On July 14th, he had paid his back rent with cash and visited at least one casino. The defendant attacked Bernice Williamson and ended up killing her, and he took her jewelry and money, Hammerin said. Hammerin said the chain of facts includes a July 14th stop at Key City Recycling, where Fischler left the pair of shoes he wore to Williamson's house. The chain includes a metal pipe found in Williamson's garage that had trace amounts of her blood on it, and an orange cap found in Fischler's vehicle that tested positive for blood in one spot. With the chain of facts, you have to put all the pieces together, Hammerin said. During the closing statement by the defense, Dreyhazov called the case against Fischler a charge of convenience. At first glance, without knowing the facts, it appears to make sense, Dreyhazov said. He told the jury that too many unanswered questions between the facts weaken the chain and cast reasonable doubt on Fischler's guilt. What the state thinks they have is not what the evidence shows, Dreyhazov said. He pointed to autopsy photos of Williamson's face in which abrasions appear to indicate a tightly woven matted pattern associated with the underside of a roll of carpet, though crime scene photos appear to show that the front side of a roll of carpet was on Williamson's face when she was injured and killed. That was one way in which Dreyhazov said there could be reasonable doubt among multiple elements of the state's evidence against Fischler. The state is telling you one thing, but the evidence is showing another thing, Dreyhazov said. The nature of Williamson's injuries was at the heart of the testimony of the only witness called to the stand Tuesday before the defense rested its case. Dr. Brad Randall, a forensic pathologist from South Dakota, testified that the patterns of Williamson's injuries indicate that the instrument used to strike her was smaller in diameter than the metal pipe investigators found in the garage of the woman's home. It had to be as thin as a quarter of an inch in diameter, Randall said. During testimony, earlier in the trial, the jury learned that one of Williamson's relatives worked at Allied Pawn, the pawn shop where Fischler sold jewelry July 15th, and that Fischler knew the employee's connection to the woman. During his closing statement, Dreyhazov asked the jury to question why Fischler would pawn jewelry that the state contends belonged to Williamson at a shop where an employee could have identified it. The state wants you to believe that Mr. Fischler is both a criminal mastermind and a complete moron at the same time, Dreyhazov said. Use common sense when you go back to the jury room. There is reasonable doubt. The jurors found no reasonable doubt when delivering the verdict. Members of the jury answered yes unanimously when Ackley polled them as to their individual verdicts. The next story is State Police Investigation Ongoing in ED by Kaylee Reese. Dateline, East Dubuque, Illinois. State officials confirmed that Illinois State Police are conducting an investigation involving East Dubuque. However, officials provided few details on what they are investigating. The investigation remains active and ongoing, Trooper Jamie Buford with the Illinois State Police Public Information Office said in an email to the Telegraph Herald. In order to protect the integrity of the investigation, no information is available at this time. Buford also could not confirm whether the city of East Dubuque was the subject of the investigation or whether the investigation was focused on certain individuals. East Dubuque city officials said they also have heard few details about the investigation. I heard there might be an investigation of something going on and that state police reached out to one or more of my city employees, city manager Loris Herrig said. We reached out to state authorities, but we haven't heard back yet. Herrig said he had been given a phone number for Mike Merritt of the Illinois State Police regarding the investigation. Merritt did not respond to the Telegraph Herald's request for comment. Both Mayor Randy Degenhart and City Attorney Terry Kurt did not return calls for comment. East Dubuque City Council members contacted for this story either did not return requests for comment or were unaware that an investigation was taking place. Joe Davies County State's Attorney Chris Allendorf said in an email to the Telegraph Herald that he did not have any comment at this time. The investigation comes 4 years after Illinois State Police previously investigated East Dubuque City employees. In 2018, the state agency investigated then Assistant Police Chief Gerald Fleurer and then City Manager Jeff Barkelow after the two were accused of making unwanted sexual advances toward women. Then Joe Davies County State's Attorney John Hay declined to file criminal charges based on the investigation, and both men denied wrongdoing. Following the investigation, the East Dubuque City Council unanimously voted to terminate Barkalow's contract. Fleur was placed on administrative leave during the investigation and ultimately resigned. The last story from the front page is, Marshallese collect PPE to send to Pacific Islands, by Joshua Irvine. When Mytha Jollett sat down with other members of the Dubuque Pacific Islander Health Project Advisory Council last week, reports of 6 confirmed cases of COVID-19 on the Marshall Islands had only just begun to roll in. That was the first significant case of community transmission in the island nation since the pandemic started more than 2 years ago. But Jollett and his peers on the advisory council already could see where this was going. Their friends and relatives living in the Marshall Islands had provided a steady stream of updates via social media since the first possible case had been reported. It's a small country, and when one thing happens, everyone knows right away, Jollett said. As cases skyrocketed in the Marshall Islands over the following week, Jollett and fellow advisory council members moved too. With the support of a half dozen Dubuque area organizations, they amassed a massive collection of medical supplies that is on its way to the islands as of Monday. There have been close to 4,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 on the Marshall Islands since the pandemic began. Nearly all of those have been confirmed in the past week, with 5 dead, according to the World Health Organization. Public broadcaster Radio New Zealand reported Sunday that more than 10% of the population in Majuro, the Marshall Islands capital, had tested positive. A loosening of quarantine protocols and a surge in visitors ahead of plans to fully open the border October 1st is suspected to be partly responsible for the outbreak. The virus's spread was unsurprising for Irene Mon, a former Marshall Islands resident and community health worker at Crescent Community Health Center, who serves on the advisory council alongside Jollett. Mon understood the potential for community spread and the unique circumstances that would facilitate it on the Marshall Islands. There, families live in multi-generational housing, often in 1 or 2 room homes that can house up to 20 people under a single roof. Commuting to work for many means island hopping from the smaller atolls to the main islands. It's pretty easy for it to spread out, Mon said. They're constantly on the move, and there's no isolation. Only about half of the islanders are vaccinated, and the residents struggle with high rates of chronic disease, such as diabetes and cancer. Many of the infected, Mon understood, were unvaccinated, including a neighbor of her family who died last week. A surge in demand for vaccinations among those who had not yet had the shot likely only added to the infection spread. When cases began to spread, reports of shortages of personal protective equipment quickly reached Mon. There's a lot of hospitals here that have run out of gloves and run out of masks, Mon said. One relative on the island reported to her that a set of 10 masks would cost $80, a particularly steep cost when the minimum wage is $2 per hour. So medical equipment became the principal focus of the advisory council's response. The council quickly reached out to local medical providers, nonprofits, and anyone who might have excess medical equipment. Right after the meeting, we went out to those people, Jollett said. Alex Baum, director of initiatives at Community Foundation of Greater Dubuque, helped to coordinate the effort. It was very much community members coming together under Marshallese leadership, Baum said. Supplies came from across the community. The Dubuque County Health Department and the United Way of Dubuque Area Tri-States donated masks. Crescent Community Health Center offered medical gowns. Sisters of Charity of the Blessed Virgin Mary and Monsoon Asians and Pacific Islanders in Solidarity also donated, while the latter further helped coordinate the effort. We really appreciate all the donors who stepped in and helped out on behalf of the community, Mon said. By Monday, the group had collected 23 boxes of medical supplies, including more than 30,000 masks. The advisory council and Baum took the hall to the post office that afternoon. It's a very special thing. one community getting together and helping another community halfway around the world, said Ann Morris, population health manager at Crescent. But the more impressive effort might have come from Dubuque's Marshallese community. Amid reports of food shortages and price gouging, the local Marshallese community has increased their remittances home, Jollett said. He and his family sent $200 to their relatives this week. Every time they need money, we send, Jollett said. That's part of our custom, helping our family and friends. Turning to page 2, the top story is Board Rejects Dubuque Landlord's Appeal to Be Removed from Priority List by John Cruz. A Dubuque board on Tuesday rejected a local property owner's request that the city remove a priority designation assigned as part of its tiered housing inspection system. The city's Housing Board of Appeals voted unanimously to affirm city staff's decision to assign Iman Al-Kadi a priority designation, which is given to landlords cited with violating property maintenance codes 3 times in 12 months. Landlords who have been given the priority designation are prioritized for regular property inspections. During the hearing, city staff highlighted 4 maintenance code violations issued to Al-Kadi from May 17, 2021 to May 17, 2022 as the primary reason for giving him the priority designation, though they noted that a total of 22 citations were issued to him in that time. City staff finds the evidence to be overwhelming in support of a priority designation, said Ben Potoff, housing inspection supervisor. Those other property owners and managers face many of the same challenges as Mr. Al-Kadi. However, the vast majority handle this situation in a very different way. Potoff said many of the issues listed in the maintenance code citations remained unaddressed for several months. Al-Kadi said he made multiple attempts to fix the problems cited in maintenance code citations issued to him, but his remediation efforts were rejected multiple times by city staff as not being sufficient. He also said the COVID-19 pandemic has created a shortage of available contractors, staff, and building materials needed to fix property issues cited by the city. The bottom line is we can't find the workers, Al-Kadi said. I put my sweat and blood in this town and millions of dollars for 18 years, and this I do not deserve. This is not the first time Al-Kadi has received a priority designation since the tiered housing inspection system was introduced in 2018. He appealed to be removed from the priority designation for the first time in March of 2019, but was rejected then as well. Al-Kadi later filed a lawsuit against the city, claiming the Housing Board of Appeals exceeded its proper jurisdiction or otherwise acted illegally while affirming the priority category property owner or agent designation. Al-Kadi and the Housing Board of Appeals came to an agreement in 2021 to dismiss the lawsuit and remove Al-Kadi from having a priority designation. Board of Appeals members said Tuesday that they sympathize with the difficulty Al-Kadi and other landlords face in addressing issues identified by city housing inspectors since the start of the pandemic, but they stressed that other landlords have been able to address those issues. Eventually, the people I didn't think would get stuff done did get it done, board member Luke Hoffman said. They were able to find some way to get it done. The next story is Dubuque mayor joins letter to Biden calling for increased resettlement of refugees by Benjamin Fisher. Dubuque Mayor Brad Kavanaugh has joined a national effort to encourage President Joe Biden's administration to meet its ambitious goals for refugee resettlement. The letter to Biden in support of that effort received by the Dubuque City Council on Monday night was drafted by the national organization Welcoming Refugees 2023. It has been signed by numerous municipal and state legislative elective officials, especially those representing metros and regional hubs, including several others in Iowa, Illinois, and Wisconsin. We call on your administration to meet its commitment to resettle refugees in fiscal year 2023 and to prioritize restoring our nation's refugee resettlement infrastructure to ensure we achieve that goal, reads the letter to Biden. Kavanaugh said the federal government expanding its refugee resettlement would not only help millions of global refugees in need, but could also help the city stave off problems of an aging population, both by embracing refugees as part of the workforce now and illustrating that Dubuque welcomes people from all backgrounds. Our city of Dubuque population has not grown the way we need it to in recent decades, he said on Tuesday. When you look ahead at the demographic reality for the next 10 or 20 years, we have a lot of work to do. We've lost a particular portion of our population over the past couple of decades. People who are my age, in their 30s and 40s, we've lost something in those working-age people who can raise their families here. If we want to grow and be a vibrant community with a high quality of life that draws people in, there are quite a few ways we need to look at this to be as welcoming as we can be. The letter expresses disappointment in the rate of refugee resettlement, especially, but not limited to, those from Afghanistan and Ukraine, giving Biden's stated goals. We applauded your action to increase the refugee admissions goal to 125,000 for FY 2022, but we are disappointingly on pace to reach less than 20% of that number, it reads. On Tuesday, a spokesperson for the U.S. Department of State said the administration has been working diligently to increase refugee resettlement, even if it had not met initial goals. The rebuilding process is well underway and will enable us to support increased admissions numbers in future years, the spokesperson said in an email. Although we will not meet this year's target this year, as we continue efforts to rebuild the program and recover from pandemic-related operations, the United States is and will continue to be a global leader in international humanitarian response, including in refugee resettlement. Kavanaugh told the Telegraph Herald that the state of Iowa, the city of Dubuque, and the federal government all have work to do to embrace refugees. U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson, Republican of Iowa, was unable to be reached Tuesday, but staff said she believes the U.S. should meet its existing refugee resettlement goals. Turning to the News in Brief column, the headline there is, authorities say man caused thousands in damage to Colesburg School and the concession stand. The dateline is Colesburg, Iowa. Authorities said a Delaware County man broke into a Colesburg concession stand and elementary school, causing thousands of dollars in damage. Tanner D. Bailey, 30, of Colesburg, is charged in Iowa District Court of Delaware County with two counts of second-degree criminal mischief, two counts of possession of burglar's tools, two counts of third-degree burglary, and one count of second-degree theft in connection with the two incidents. Court documents state that Colesburg Community Development Group reported July 28th that the concession stand at the softball complex on Parkview Court had been broken into the night before. Two steel doors had been pried open with a pry bar, causing about $3,000 in damage. Documents also state that on August 2nd, Bailey gained forcible entry into Edgewood Colesburg Elementary School, 409 East Street, using a battery-operated grinder. Bailey stole more than $1,500 worth of items from the school, documents state. Bailey also damaged the school entry door, left the freezer door open, and frozen food spoiled and destroyed school cabinets, documents state. The total damage exceeded $1,500, but was less than $10,000. A search warrant was executed on Bailey's residence August 4th. Several of the items stolen from the school were found, as well as candy bars stolen from the concession stand, documents state. The battery-operated grinder and the large pry bar believed to have been used on the concession stand doors also were found. And Delaware County hires new county engineer, Dateline Manchester, Iowa. The Delaware County Board of Supervisors recently hired a new county engineer. Rafe Koopman started in the job Monday, replacing Anthony Bargett, who resigned in July to take an area transportation engineer position with the Iowa Department of Transportation. Koopman previously was the Clayton County engineer, and he had worked for the county for 19 years. Delaware County supervisors agreed to a 3-year contract with Koopman, with compensation for the remainder of fiscal year 2022 and 23 set at $127,500. Shirley Helmrichs, chair of the Board of Supervisors, said the interviewers appreciated Koopman's experience, personality, and work ethic. She said Clayton County officials inquired about sharing Koopman with Delaware County, but that Delaware County officials were not interested as they had just come off an agreement in which they shared Bargett with Dubuque County. And then the police report. The Dubuque County Police and Dubuque County Sheriff's Office reported Brittany A. Bromley, 22, of 2400 Windsor Avenue, was arrested at 10:22 p.m. Monday at her residence on charges of assault causing injury, child endangerment, and public intoxication. Court documents state that Bromley assaulted Nicole A. Hopman, 39, of 2506 Windsor Avenue, outside of Hopman's residence Monday, in the presence of a 1-year-old child. Adam C. Spinoza, 28, of Asbury, Iowa, was arrested at 4:25 p.m. Monday at 1954 Ellis Street on a warrant charging possession of heroin. Stephanie P. Hoppert, 36, of 1611 Main Street, Apartment 3, was arrested at 9:15 a.m. Monday at Dubuque Law Enforcement Center on a warrant charging third-degree theft. CatSpec Limited of LaPorte, Texas, reported the theft of $3,015 worth of property from a vehicle parked at 450 Main Street between about 8 p.m. Sunday and 5:45 a.m. Monday. Michael E. Hocking, 70, of 2173 St. John Drive, reported the theft of a catalytic converter worth $2,000, as well as $2,000 worth of damage to a vehicle at 1800 Radford Road at about 10:20 a.m. Monday. And Lori L. Holzer, 49, of 1965 Scenic View Drive, reported $600 worth of damage to her residence at about 6:35 p.m. Monday. Turning to the opinion page, there is a article titled Finding Middle Ground in Debate Over Abortion in the Another View column by Jim Swenson. It's becoming increasingly rare to publicly express a nuanced, middle-of-the-road opinion on anything. Extremes on both sides dominate the public forum. They demand unquestioned devotion, or else fill in here with their respective rhetoric. The abortion issue is no different. If you cut through the all-or-nothing viewpoints on it, most people make distinctions on where they stand. Polls conducted this year bear this out. One from Gallup, taken mostly after the draft of the Roe v. Wade decision was leaked, found that 55% were pro-choice, the most since 1995. Yet only 35% of respondents believed it should be legal under any circumstances, while just 13% that it should be illegal in all circumstances. Recent Pew Research broke it down even further into pregnancy milestones of 6, 14, and 24 weeks on whether abortion should be legal or illegal in all or most cases. On one side, 47% thought it should be legal after 6 weeks, generally accepted as when a fetal heartbeat can be detected. That number dropped to 37% after 14 weeks and to only 18% after 24 weeks. On the other side, 26% believed it should be illegal after 6 weeks, 33% after 14 weeks, and 48% after 24 weeks. Then there's the loud scare tactic rhetoric, use of partial birth abortions and abortions due to rape or incest as arguments. The statistics I found state that only 1% of abortions occur at 21 weeks or more, while between just 0.5 to 1% are done because of rape, and only 0.01 to 0.5% are due to incest. I have friends and relatives, male and female, on both sides of the issue. It's undeniably clear to one side that it's a woman's body and her right to choose. It's just as obvious on the other side that the unborn baby is another human being with a right to life. I try hard to understand both viewpoints. Most independents, such as myself, likely lean one way or another. We just don't fall off the far edges into the abyss of groupthink. If you can't see the hypocrisy on both sides, you're probably not an independent. Is one side more hypocritical than the other? The extremes believe so. I don't. Some pro-life people who base their beliefs on religious grounds also side with capital punishment. Seems inconsistent. If the criminal on the cross next to Jesus was saved at the last moment, couldn't others on death row be saved as well? Some pro-choice people criticize those who choose not to wear a COVID mask. They claim that such a choice could impact others. Sure, a maskless person might infect someone else. That someone else has a slight possibility of ending up in the hospital and an even less chance of dying. The impact from choosing to have an abortion after 6 weeks is the end of another heartbeat. Period. And that opinion piece was by Jim Swenson. You are listening to a reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Wednesday, August 17th, 2022, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Next, we'll turn to today's obituaries. Wendy Priest. Wendy Lynn Howell Priest, 68, passed away Monday, August 15, 2022, at Stonehill Care Center after suffering for 10 years with a very rare degenerative brain disease known as PSP, progressive supranuclear palsy. Visitation will be from 9 to 10:45 a.m. Thursday at Our Redeemer Lutheran Church, 2145 John F. Kennedy Road, followed by the funeral service at 11 a.m. Beverly A. White, West Burlington, Iowa. Beverly Ann White, 88, of West Burlington, Iowa, formerly of Dyersville, Iowa, and Kansas City, Missouri, passed away surrounded by her family on August 10, 2022, at the Klein Center in West Burlington, Iowa. Family and friends of Beverly may gather from 10 to 12 p.m. on Thursday, August 18, 2022, at the Rife Funeral Home in Dyersville, Iowa, where a memorial service will be held at 12 p.m. with Pastor Maxine Dennison presiding. Burial will be held in St. Francis Cemetery in Dyersville, Iowa. Beverly was born February 3, 1934, in Dundee, Iowa. Camilla M. Jarks. Robert Green Camilla May Jarks was unequivocally better than a master of one, seamstress, carpenter, scuba diver, lifeguard, artist, pilot, administrative assistant, entrepreneur, clothing retailer, graphic designer, voracious reader, lover of learning, as if she would live forever. She has lost her battle with Alzheimer's disease, and it is a shame that such a fruitful mind had to be devoured by unforgiving dementia. Camilla passed away on August 13, 2022, at home. Visitation will be from 4:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. Wednesday, August 17, 2022, at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road. Family and friends may also gather after 9 a.m. Thursday, August 18, 2022, at St. Paul's Lutheran Church, where a service will be held at 10 a.m. with the Reverend John Crawford officiating. Burial will be in Linwood Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to one of the following links: donations.peointernational.org or npr.org donations support. Diane K. Holmes. Diane K. Donahue Holmes of Dubuque passed away at home on August 13, 2022, at the age of 76. Visitation will be from 4 to 6 p.m. Thursday, August 18, 2022, at St. Columbkill Catholic Church. Massive Christian burial will be at 10 a.m. Friday, August 19, 2022, at St. Columbkill Catholic Church with the Father Tom McDermott officiating. Burial will follow in Mount Olivet Cemetery. A live stream of the funeral mass will be on Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory's Facebook page. Ardith A. Meeker. Ardith A. Artie Meeker, 93, of Dubuque, died on Wednesday, August 10, 2022. Visitation will be held from 9:45 to 10:15 a.m. Saturday, August 20th, at St. Peter Lutheran Church, where services will follow at 10:30 a.m. Burial will take place in Highview Cemetery in Epworth, Iowa. Rife Funeral Home of Epworth is assisting the family. Robert J. Johnson, Galena, Illinois. Robert J. Bob Johnson of Galena, Illinois, died peacefully at Bethany Home in Dubuque on Monday, July 18th, after 91 wonderful years. Funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. August 20th, 2022 at Furlong Funeral Chapel, Galena, where friends may call after 9 a.m. until the time of service. Bob's ashes will be buried at St. Michael's Cemetery, Galena, with half going to Grand Forks, North Dakota, to rest on the Butler family plot next to Betty. Cremation rites have been accorded. John R. Lawler, Zwingle, Iowa. John R. Jack Lawler, 74, of Zwingle and formerly of Key West, passed away on Saturday, August 13th, at home, surrounded by his loving family. Visitation will be Thursday, August 18th, 2022, from 3 to 8 p.m. at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road, where a family wake service will be at 2:45 p.m. A massive Christian burial will be on Friday, August 19th at 10:30 a.m. at St. Joseph's Key West Church with Monsignor Thomas Toll as the celebrant. Burial will follow in Mount Olivet Cemetery with military honors accorded by American Legion Post 528 of Cascade. Henry Ehrlich, Dyersville, Iowa. Henry J. Ehrlich, 87, of Dyersville, Iowa, peacefully passed away on August 15, 2022, in the Marietta Place Memory Care Unit at the Good Neighbor Society in Manchester, Iowa. Visitation will be held from 3 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, August 18, 2022, at Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville. Visitation will continue at the funeral home from 9 to 10 a.m. prior to the funeral mass. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Friday, August 19, 2022, at St. Francis Xavier Basilica in Dyersville, with burial in the church cemetery. Reverend Gabriel Mensah will officiate, and Deacon Jim Stegger will concelebrate. Diane Christensen, Monona, Iowa. Diane Christensen, 82, of Monona, died on Monday, August 15, 2022. Visitation will be held from 10 to 11 a.m. Monday, August 22nd, at St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Monona, where services will follow. Interment will follow in Monona Cemetery. Leonard Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Monona is assisting the family. Margaret A. Pape. Margaret A. Pape, 98, of Dubuque, died on Saturday, August 13, 2022. Visitation will be held from 9:30 to 10:45 a.m. Tuesday, August 23rd, at St. Anthony's Catholic Church, where a massive Christian burial will follow at 11 a.m. Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory, 3860 Asbury Road, is assisting the family. Ricky J. Olson, Cuba City, Wisconsin. Ricky J. Olson, 65, of Cuba City, died on Tuesday, August 16, 2022. Visitation will be held from 12:30 to 2 p.m. Saturday, August 20th, at Houdenshield Funeral Home and Cremation Services in Cuba City, where services will follow. Burial will take place in Mount Pleasant Cemetery in Cuba City. Patricia Grigo. Patricia Grigo, 92, of Dubuque, died on Friday, August 12, 2022. A massive Christian burial will take place at 11 a.m. Tuesday, August 23rd, at St. Patrick's Catholic Church. Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory, 2569 John F. Kennedy Road, is assisting the family. Martin D. Conan. Marty D. Conan, 67, of Dubuque, died on Tuesday, August 9, 2022. No services were held. Burial took place at Mount Calvary Cemetery. Hoffman, Schneider, and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory, 3860 Asbury Road, assisted the family. Brenda M. Bloch. Brenda M. Bloch, 89, of Dubuque, died on Monday, August 1, 2022. Services will take place at 4:30 p.m. Monday, August 22nd, at Engelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory, 2659 John F. Kennedy Road, where visitation will follow. And in funeral services, John J. Baston, Galena, Illinois, visitation 1 to 4 p.m. Sunday, August 21st, Furlong Funeral Chapel, Galena. Anthony J. Burbach, Dubuque, massive Christian burial, 10:30 a.m. today, St. Anthony's Catholic Church. Elizabeth J. Davies, Lancaster, Wisconsin, visitation is 3 to 7 p.m. today and from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Thursday, August 18th. Lancaster United Methodist Church, service 10:30 a.m. Thursday at the church. Betty DeShaw, Hopkinton, Iowa, visitation 9 to 10:30 a.m. Friday, August 19th, St. Paul's Catholic Church, Worthington. Mass of Christian burial, 10:30 a.m. Friday at the church. Judith A. Kolker, Bellevue, Iowa, visitation 9 to 10 a.m. today, Hockman Meyer Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Bellevue. Service 10:30 a.m. today, St. Joseph's Catholic Church, Bellevue. Zelda J. Myers, Dubuque, visitation 9:30 to 10:15 a.m. today, Church of the Resurrection, Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. today at the church. Eugene D. Myers, Rui, Wisconsin, visitation 4 to 7 p.m. today and from 9 to 11 a.m. Thursday, August 18th, Soman Larson Funeral Home, Montfort, Wisconsin. Service 11 a.m. Thursday at the funeral home. Colleen M. O'Hare, Dubuque, visitation 9 to 11 a.m. today, Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory, 3860 Asbury Road. Service 11 a.m. today at the funeral home. Stephen J. Post, Bellevue, Iowa, visitation 1 to 3 p.m. today, Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road. Service 3 p.m. today at the funeral home. Mary Ann Puff, Marietta, Georgia, visitation 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Saturday, August 20th, Church of the Nativity, Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. Saturday at the church. Francis J. Rundy, Hazel Green, Wisconsin, visitation 9 to 9:45 a.m. Saturday, August 20th, St. Joseph's Catholic Church, Cincinnati, Wisconsin. Service 10 a.m. Saturday at the church. John J. Vondra, Warren, Illinois, visitation 4 to 8 p.m. Friday, August 19th, Bartell Lemon Funeral Home in Warren. Service 10 a.m. Saturday, August 20th, Holy Cross Catholic Church, Stockton. And Marilyn A. Weber, Earlville, Iowa, visitation 4 to 8 p.m. today with scripture service at 7 p.m. Clifton Murdoch Funeral Home, Earlville, Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. Thursday, August 18th, St. Joseph Catholic Church, Earlville. Turning to the sports page, the kickoff of the 2022 Six Rivers Conference. New Look in Six Rivers by Tim O'Neill. Mark Siegert has been around Wisconsin football long enough to know a solid conference when he sees it. For years, the Six Rivers Conference has been one of the toughest small school leagues in the state. And the Potosi-Cassville coach expects the 2022 season to be more of the same, especially with an influx of out-of-state talent. The Six Rivers Conference is, in my opinion, the best Division VII conference in the state, as past representation in the WIAA playoffs would attest to, Siegert wrote in his preseason questionnaire. There are simply no off nights, as all teams have outstanding programs, and now, with the addition of Southwestern East Dubuque, only enhancing that. Southwestern competed in the Six Rivers Conference as a standalone program last season, but injuries zapped an already thin roster, and the Wildcats were unable to finish the season. With the prognosis even more grim for this season, the offseason was spent trying to find a partner for a co-op. Since moving to 8-player would have resulted in a lengthy postseason ban. East Dubuque wasn't necessarily in the same position, but could have seen a potential move to 8-player on the horizon. The Six Rivers is no stranger to cooperative programs with Illinois ties. Of the 6 teams in the conference, 5 are co-ops and 3, Southwestern, East Dubuque, Blackhawk Warren, and Benton Scales Mound Shelsburg include teams from Illinois. Here is a capsule look at area programs competing in the Six Rivers this fall. Benton Scales Mound Shelsburg, coach Todd Bastian, last year 3-8 overall, 3-4 in Six Rivers. Returning veterans are Chad Heffley, senior, 5'11", 150 pounds. Jacob Dewar, senior, 5'11", 155. Luke Jansen, senior, 5'9", 150. Trevor Andrews, junior, 5'7", 130. Evan Peterson, senior, 5'9", 150. Nate Lawrence, senior, 6 feet and 160 pounds. Ryan Winter, sophomore, 5'11", 150 pounds. Michael Winter, junior, 5'9", 190 pounds. Nevada Sandlin, senior, 5'9", 140 pounds. Caden Leffelholtz, sophomore, 5'11", 135 pounds. Peyton Calvert, he's a junior, he's 6 feet and he's 205 pounds. Landon Leahy, senior, 6 feet, 195 pounds. Braden Gunnell, senior, 6 feet, 225 pounds. Colin Montaigne, senior, 5'10", 190 pounds. Jonah Driscoll, junior, 6'1", 225 pounds. TJ Nelson, sophomore, 6 feet, 200 pounds. Charlie Weigel, senior, 5'7", 135 pounds. And Cody Haynes, senior, 6'3", 165. The outlook. The Knights have a big group of returning veterans back this year and hope an off-season of workouts can help erase the bad taste from last season. The team returns its quarterback, top 3 rushers, top 3 receivers, and 5 of its top 6 tackles from a year ago. The biggest key to replace is Ben Werner, the league's offensive lineman and defensive player of the year in 2021. In Potosi-Cassville, the coach is Mark Siegert in his 24th season. Last year, 10-2 overall, 6-1 in Six Rivers. The outlook? Potosi-Cassville and Potosi, as a standalone program even further back, has been a contender in the Six Rivers for years under Siegert and the program, and expects no less this season after sharing the conference championship last year. The team returns a dozen starters from last year's team and another healthy group of veterans to add depth and experience in holes vacated by graduation. Siegert is pleased with the size of the roster for a Division VII program and sees a group that has worked diligently in the off-season and is ready to go once the season gets underway. Southwestern East Dubuque. Coach John Edler. Last year, first year as a program, Southwestern went 3-3 and East Dubuque was 3-6 last season as standalone programs. The outlook. The Warcats are set for their first season as a cooperative program this fall, one of the 5 co-ops in the 6-team Six Rivers Conference. Edler, the East Dubuque coach last year, takes over the program, and he sees reason for high expectations. With a large group of returning starters, experience and depth figure to be strengths, and allows underclassmen to develop at the junior varsity level. A summer in the weight room brings added enthusiasm. In prep softball, Edema picks DePaul. And this is Dubuque Hempstead by Tim O'Neill. A few short weeks later, a substitute appearance helped put her on the radar. A few short weeks later, Lydia Edema's college destination was secured. Edema, a four-year standout for Dubuque Hempstead, verbally committed to a full-ride scholarship offer to play softball for DePaul University beginning in 2023. It was pretty quick, honestly. Things kind of sped up pretty quickly, and I just fell in love, said Edema, who will be entering her senior year at Hempstead. When I went on my visit, I just absolutely loved it. It felt like home. She plans to major in biology with a minor in psychology. After graduation, she hopes to become a psychiatrist and work with patients with mental disabilities. Edema, who plans most of her travel softball with the Lady Expos organization, was subbing for Nebraska Gold at a tournament in Kansas City. That, she said, is when DePaul's coaches took notice. Shortly after Hempstead's season ended, she went to a camp hosted by the DePaul program. A short time later, she received a text message inviting her for a campus visit. She enjoyed her visit and the campus, but head coach Tracy Adick-Zins sealed the deal. She felt like a mom almost, not in a weird way or anything, but she's a very enthusiastic and very lively person, and she just wants what's best for all of her players, Edema said. I really gravitated toward her because of that, just because she had so much energy. Hempstead coach Danielle Krug and Lady Expos coach Tony Hauslog, they both bring a lot of energy to the table, and I love that about a coach, and I definitely needed that. Speaking of the Lady Expos, Edema is the third player from the organization to commit to an NCAA Division I program recently. Her Hempstead teammate, Jaden Glab, is committed to the University of Washington. Cascades' Devin Simon is headed to the University of Iowa. Glab and Edema, best friends, plan to sign their national letters of intent together at Hempstead sometime during the fall signing period. Edema has played for the Lady Expos since she was 9, she said. She is also coached by Mark Heffel. They deserve a lot of credit for how I got recruited and the time and effort they put into me, because I wouldn't be where I am today without them, she said. Edema hit .338 for 16 runs, 11 doubles, 4 home runs, and 32 RBIs for the Mustangs this summer, but her biggest improvement came in the pitching circle. She went 11-2 with a 1.05 earned run average over 80 and a third innings. She struck out 49, but walked only 6 and did not hit a batter as she pitched primarily the second game of doubleheaders. I just had a lot of confidence this year, and with the players as well, Edema said. I just felt more of a team. And I think it was also a leadership thing. I think I matured more as an athlete and had a different mindset coming in this year of, it's not about numbers, it's about playing together as a team. Local and area roundup. Mustang Swigerth claims medalist honors. Will Swigerth fired a 3-under par 69 to earn medalist honors and help Dubuque Hempstead finish second at a Mississippi Valley Conference quadrangle Tuesday in Waterloo, Iowa. Swigerth carded 5 birdies and 11 pars at Irv Warren Golf Course. The Mustangs finished runner-up to Iowa City West, 310 to 322. Dubuque's senior, 323, was third, followed by host Waterloo West at 371. Drew Lewis had an 82, Grant Nelson an 85, and Charlie Setter, 86, rounded out Hempstead scoring. Ryan Udy led the Rams with a 77. Nate Obink had an 80, Owen King an 80, and Barrett Reed had 86, and they also scored for senior. Galena, 178, Amboy, 199 at Galena, Illinois. Ryan Stoffengren shot even par 37 to earn medalist honors and lead the Pirates to victory over Amboy at Galena Golf Club. And Fulton, 161, East Dubuque, 220 at Fulton, Illinois. Crew Meyer shot 52 to lead East Dubuque in a dual loss to Fulton at Fulton Golf Course. And in girls' golf, Galena 212, Amboy 313 at Galena, Illinois. Aiden Wells carded a 49 to lead the Pirates to victory over Amboy. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Wednesday, August 17th, 2022. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thank you for listening.